in the language of physical touch is not to get your own desires met, but to make your wife feel genuinely loved and cared for. If she senses that your efforts at physical touch are merely preludes to sex, ways to get her in the mood, she may start to resent them, and in the process, you'll lose some credibility. Physical touch is not code for foreplay. Your wife needs to know that your aim is true, your intentions are noble, and your efforts are directed at her. If that means removing sex from the love language equation, so be it. The two of you can address your physical intimacy in another setting. There are three points we must reiterate in the context of physical touch and sex. The first involves appropriate and inappropriate touching. Remember, it's your wife who draws the line. If she's uncomfortable with touching that borders on groping, she should feel free to tell you so. That way, you can adjust your actions accordingly. Her feelings must be respected. Second, the fact that your wife's reaction to physical touch is so fraught with meaning means that any betrayal in that area will be devastating to her, more so than it might be for someone else. Marriage counselors' files are filled with records of husbands and wives who are grappling with the emotional trauma of an unfaithful spouse. That trauma, however, is compounded for the individual whose primary love language is physical touch. The idea of the love for which he longs being given to another person is almost too much to bear. Her emotional love tank is not only drained, it is exploded. Only massive repairs can fix the damage. Third, if sexual intercourse is indeed your wife's primary dialect, nothing should stop you from becoming the best lover you can possibly be for her. The more you read about and discuss the art of sexual lovemaking, the more you will improve your ability to express love in that way. When it's needed most. If physical touch is important under normal circumstances, it is absolutely essential in times of crisis. Even people who don't speak physical touch as their primary love language almost instinctively cling to one another in times of emergency, loss, and upheaval. The more serious the situation, the more likely we are to hug or clasp hands. That's a testament to the power of physical touch to communicate love. In a time of crisis, more than anything, we need to feel loved. We cannot always change events, but we can survive if we feel loved. All marriages will experience crisis. Some can be anticipated, others can't. The death of parents is inevitable. Automobile accidents injure and kill thousands every year. Disease is no respecter of persons. Disappointments are a part of life. The most important thing you can do for your wife in a time of crisis is to love her. If her primary love language is physical touch, nothing is more important than holding her as she cries. Your words may mean little, but your physical touch will communicate that you care. A crisis provides a unique opportunity for expressing love. It's vital that you seize that opportunity. Your tender touch will be remembered long after the crisis has passed. Your failure to touch may never be forgotten. Physical Touch Phrasebook. Think of this as a starter's kit or an emergency resource for communicating in the love language of physical touch. If you're stuck for an idea of how to show tactile love to your wife, try one of these suggestions. Make touching your wife a normal part of your routine. Run your fingers through her hair while she's reading. Touch her shoulder as she works in the kitchen. Even the smallest acts can build intimacy over time. Make a point of hugging and kissing your wife when you say goodbye in the morning, when you come home in the evening, and before you go to bed at night. It's easy to let these rituals slide, particularly when you've been married for a while. Change your usual patterns and routines to encourage more physical contact between you and your wife. If each of you has a special chair, move them to within arm's length of each other. Switch sides of the bed. The awkwardness of the new arrangement is likely to lead to unexpected touching opportunities. If the two of you normally sit across from each other in a restaurant, next time get a booth and sit side by side. If you usually sit side by side, next time sit across from each other and engage in a little foot play under the table. Set aside an evening for some touch experiments to determine where your wife most likes to be touched. As you move from spot to spot, ask her to give you a thumbs up, a thumbs down, or an indifferent thumb sideways to indicate her reaction. Make a mental note of the spots that get a thumbs up. Check out websites, DVDs, and books that teach various techniques of body massage. Experiment to see which methods your wife enjoys most. Think back to your early dates and recall the thrill of physical touch that perhaps you now take for granted. The next time you're alone with your wife, try to rekindle some of that original excitement. The next time you shop for your wife, look for things that will appeal to her tactile nature, things that are pleasant to touch, such as a cashmere sweater, a plush throw pillow, or warm, fuzzy slippers. The next time she's sick, remember the healing power of touch. When her head hurts, offer to rub her neck and temples. When she's suffering from a cold or flu, frequently rub her forehead. If you have kids, train them to show love for mom through physical touch. Make it a tradition in your household for the family to hold hands during prayer. Encourage your children to be generous with their hugs. The more often you model physically affirming behavior toward your wife, the more likely it is your kids will follow your example. For a designated period of time, communicate with your wife using only physical touch. Don't say anything as you shower her with physical affection. When she's facing away from you in bed, write short messages on her back and see if she can tell what you're writing. For your information, "I adore you" will get a much better reaction than "time to vacuum." Chapter 7. What languages do you speak? Maybe you had an aha moment the first time you glanced at a list of the 5 love languages. Maybe you listened to the chapter on words of affirmation or acts of service and said, "Bingo, that's me," or "That's definitely my wife." Then again, maybe it didn't happen that way. For many people, discovering a primary love language, your spouse's or your own, is a challenge. The clues aren't always as obvious as we might hope. We shouldn't be surprised. We are, after all, complex individuals. We have a variety of interests. We respond to all kinds of stimuli. There's no reason people should expect to figure us out quickly. As a result of that complexity, many couples operate under false assumptions when it comes to love languages. How many wives have drawers full of jewelry, stuffed animals, frilly lingerie, and other gifts that their husbands were sure would make them feel loved? How many husbands cringe in embarrassment at the memory of words of affirmation that fell flat? How many spouses still harbor resentment over acts of service that went unnoticed? How many of them appreciate what their spouses are trying to do, but secretly wish for a little less quality time or physical touch? The official love language of men? Likewise, how many well-meaning people have fooled themselves and their spouses when it comes to their own love language? Guys are especially susceptible to self-deception in this area for one simple reason: sex. Most guys would admit to enjoying sex a lot. So much so, in fact, that they assume physical touch is their primary love language and sexual intercourse is their dialect. That's sound logic, isn't it? Not necessarily. As you no doubt remember from health class, sexual desire in males is physically based. The desire for sexual intercourse is stimulated by the buildup of seminal fluid in the seminal vesicles. When the seminal vesicles are full, there is a physical push for release. Thus, the male's desire for sexual intercourse has a physical root. It's not necessarily related to his love language. If you're uncertain as to whether physical touch is your primary love language, consider whether you enjoy hands-on contact outside the bedroom. Are you energized by hand-holding, back rubs, and affectionate caresses? If not, physical touch may not be your love language. Sexual desire is quite different from the emotional need to feel loved. That doesn't mean sexual intercourse is unimportant to the person who speaks a love language other than physical touch. It's extremely important. But sexual intercourse alone will not meet a husband's need to feel loved. His wife must speak his primary emotional love language as well. When his wife speaks his primary love language, and his emotional love tank is full, and he speaks her primary love language, and her emotional love tank is full, the sexual aspect of their relationship will likely take care of itself. Most sexual problems in marriage have little to do with physical technique, but everything to do with meeting emotional needs. Know thyself. So what is your primary love language? What makes you feel most loved by your wife? What do you desire above all else? If the answer to those questions doesn't leap to your mind immediately, try a different approach. Think about the negative use of love languages. What does your wife do or say or fail to do or say that hurts you deeply? Your answers will be instructive. If, for example, your deepest pain is caused by the critical, judgmental words of your wife, then your primary love language may be words of affirmation. Makes sense, right? If your primary love language is used negatively by your wife, that is, if she does the opposite of what you desire, it will hurt you more deeply than it would hurt someone else. Not only is she neglecting to speak your primary love language, but she's actually using that language as a weapon against you. If it grieves you deeply that your wife seldom gives you a gift for any occasion, then perhaps your primary love language is gift-giving. If your deepest hurt is that your wife seldom gives you quality time, then it seems reasonable to assume that quality time is your primary love language. Another approach to discovering your primary love language is to look back over your marriage and ask, "What have I most often requested of my wife?" The answer will likely reveal your primary love language. Though your requests may occasionally have been interpreted as nagging by your wife, they are, in fact, your efforts to secure emotional love from her. Likewise, your wife's most frequent request to you probably indicates her primary love language. Yet another way to discover your primary love language is to examine what you do or say to express love to your wife. Chances are, what you're doing for her is what you wish she would do for you. If you're constantly doing acts of service for your wife, perhaps, though not always, that is your love language. If words of affirmation speak love to you, chances are you'll use them in speaking to your wife. Thus, you may discover your own primary love language by asking, "How do I consciously express my love to my wife?" This approach will yield only a potential clue to your love language. It is not an absolute indicator. For example, the husband who learned from his father to show love to his wife by giving her nice gifts expresses his love to his wife by doing what his father did. Yet gift-giving is not his primary love language. He's simply doing what he was trained to do by his father. Speak for yourself. Elizabeth says, "Whenever I look back over the last 10 years of my marriage and ask myself what I have most requested of Peter, my love language becomes obvious. I have requested quality time most often. Over and over again, I have asked him if we could go on a picnic, take a weekend together away, shut the TV off for just an hour and talk with each other, take a walk together, and on and on. I have felt neglected and unloved because seldom did he ever respond to my request. He gave me nice gifts for my birthday and special occasions and wondered why I wasn't excited about them. Follow the sound of the criticism. Spouses tend to criticize each other most loudly in the areas where they themselves have the deepest emotional need. Their criticism is an effective way of pleading for love. If we understand that, it may help us process criticism in a more productive manner. You may say to your wife after she gives you a criticism, "It sounds like that's extremely important to you. Could you explain why it's so crucial?" Criticism often needs clarification. Initiating such a conversation may eventually turn the criticism into a request rather than a demand. Let's say Christina criticizes her husband Jeff for hunting, which happens to be his favorite pastime. She knows it relaxes him and gives him a much-needed opportunity to spend time outdoors and with his friends. Yet, she complains about it every chance she gets. She exaggerates the amount of time he actually spends hunting and says he never spends that kind of time on her. In reality, her criticism may not be an expression of her hatred for hunting. Instead, she may be blaming hunting as the thing that keeps Jeff from vacuuming the house or mowing the grass. When Jeff learns to meet her need for love by speaking her emotional love language, acts of service, Christina will likely start to support him in his passion for hunting. Too close to call. If two love languages seem to be equal for you, that is, if both speak loudly to you, then perhaps you are bilingual. If so, you make things much easier for your wife. You give her two options for filling your love tank, either of which will strongly communicate affection to you. If you'd prefer to break an apparent tie or get a more definitive take on your primary love language, you may wish to take the 5 love languages profile found in the PDF accompanying this audiobook or online at 5lovelanguages.com. Consider your answers carefully. When you're finished, discuss your results with your wife. Get her input. Does she recognize that love language in you? Then have her take the profile too. If the profile fails to reveal a definitive answer, don't give up. I've found that two kinds of people may have difficulty discovering their primary love language. The first is the individual whose emotional love tank has been full for a long time. His wife has expressed love to him in so many different ways, he's not sure which of those ways makes him feel most loved. Poor guy. We should all have such problems. The second is the individual whose love tank has been empty for so long that he doesn't remember what makes him feel loved. The circumstances that lead to such a pitiful state of affairs will vary from person to person. However, what these people have in common is the assurance that their condition need not be permanent. Love languages don't disappear. They simply lie dormant, waiting to be rediscovered. The best way to rediscover your love language is to recall your experience of falling in love and ask yourself, what did I like about my wife in those days? What did she do or say that made me desire to be with her? If you can conjure up those memories, you will get some idea as to your primary love language. With that in mind, let me suggest also that you spend some time writing down what you think is your primary love language. Then list the other 4 love languages in order of importance. Also write down what you think is the primary love language of your wife. You may also list the other 4 in order of importance if you wish. Ask your wife to do the same. Sit down together and discuss what you guess to be each other's primary love language. Then reveal what you consider to be your own primary love language. One of the best ways to confirm your findings is to play a game with your wife called Tank Check. The Tank Check Game. Number of players, 2, you and your wife. Frequency, play 3 times a week for 3 weeks. How to play. When you are both home in the evening, your wife starts the game by asking, on a scale of 0 to 10, how is your love tank tonight? 0 means empty, 10 means I am full of love and can't handle any more. You give a reading on your emotional love tank, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, or 0, indicating how full it is. Your wife asks, what can I do to help fill it? Then you make a suggestion, something you would like your wife to do or say that evening. To the best of her ability, she will respond to your request. Then you ask your wife the same question so that both of you have the opportunity to do readings on your love tanks and make suggestions toward filling them. If you play the game for 3 weeks, you will be hooked on it, and it can become a playful way of stimulating love expressions in your marriage. Where do we go from here? As we mentioned earlier in the book, most people marry someone whose primary love language is different from theirs. If that's the case with you and your wife, spend some time talking about your differences. Let's say your primary love language is physical touch, and your wife's is quality time. What does that mean? Start your discussion at the most practical level. For one thing, it means your wife would feel most comfortable showing you love by hanging out with you, doing the things you do, and it means you would feel most comfortable showing love to your wife through kisses, hugs, caresses, and back rubs. Freeze the discussion there for a moment. You've talked about what would be comfortable for you both. Unfortunately, what's comfortable for each of you won't impact the other. In order to become fluent in your wife's love language, you must step out of your comfort zone, and your wife must do the same for you. To take those steps, to put your wife's needs ahead of your own comfort, is an act of love in itself. You're showing your wife that you're willing to do whatever it takes to make your relationship better and stronger, and to make your wife feel spectacularly loved. It's vital that you keep those sacrifices, that willingness to step outside your comfort zones, in mind whenever you feel annoyed or frustrated with your wife's attempts to communicate via your love language. Remember, it isn't her native tongue. She's ventured outside her comfort zone for you. Appreciation and gratitude must be shown. It may not always be pretty. It may not always be effective, but it is genuine. The more leeway and understanding you give each other as you try to learn each other's love language, the more success you'll have. At a glance, discovering your love language. If you don't have time to listen through the entire chapter right now, here's the key info you need in ultra-condensed form. To identify your primary love language, ask yourself 3 questions. 1. What does your wife do or fail to do that hurts you most deeply? The opposite of what hurts you most is probably your love language. 2. What have you most often requested of your wife? That is likely the thing that would make you feel most loved. 3. In what way do you regularly express love to your wife? Your method of expressing love may be the method that would also make you feel loved. Chapter 8. Troubleshooting. In an ideal world, a couple would discover each other's love language on their very first date. Then, as their relationship grew, so would their communication and appreciation for each other. Their efforts to become fluent would coincide with their falling in love. By the time they got married, both of them would be bilingual in love languages. As you may have noticed, we don't live in an ideal world. We live in a world where the New York Yankees can capture 27 world championships in 86 years, and the Chicago Cubs can go over 100 years without winning one. Baseball aside, the reality for many couples is that they allow their feelings of romance, excitement, and in-loveness to carry them into marriage before they've had a chance to consider each other's love language. From there, the busyness and pressures of everyday life leave them little or no energy to learn. So they do what they can, stick to the language they know, and hope for the best. Unfortunately, hope is a lousy defense against the many issues that lie ahead. Annoyances, mistakes, frustrations, fears, dissatisfaction, boredom, incompatibility, temptations, regrets, troubles. Over time, couples discover that sticking to what they know works only for so long, if indeed it ever worked at all. No matter what they do, their best efforts never seem to be good enough. Their spouse never seems satisfied. The in-loveness that carried them to the altar dissipates, leaving two people who bear little resemblance to the starry-eyed lovebirds in their wedding photos. Whether they verbalize it or not, husbands and wives who want to avoid divorce and stay together still face a choice. Their first option is to lower their expectations and accept the new status quo. They can choose to live with the diminishing returns of their relationship and stay together for a number of reasons. They stick it out for the sake of the kids. Staying married means less hassle and expense than splitting up. They don't hate each other, exactly. They want to avoid a major life change, which can be scary. Their second option is to figure out what's wrong with the relationship and work to make it better. To refuse to settle for the status quo. To find new and creative ways of communicating love and affection for each other. Making the tough call. The second option is the better one, but it's certainly not the easier one, especially if damage has already been done to the relationship. Every marriage has its ups and downs, of course. In some, however, the ups aren't quite as high as the couple imagined, and the downs are considerably lower and longer than they'd ever thought possible. Over time, those lows, as well as the incidents and circumstances that caused them, can take a toll. Past annoyances, disagreements, and mistakes become obstacles to intimacy. The shrapnel damage from previous emotional warfare can leave spouses feeling too wounded to talk about their day, let alone try to communicate in an unfamiliar love language. With their love tanks bone dry or running on fumes, spouses allow resentment and anger to take hold. The question then becomes, how do they work their way through the emotional minefields they created together? How do they begin to address years of heated words, regrettable choices, unresolved issues, and silent resentment? They choose to. Just as they chose to put those obstacles there in the first place. They chose to speak critical words. They chose to allow their emotions in the driver's seat. They chose to put other priorities ahead of their relationship. They can choose to love. The right words. Let's say you've made some choices you're not proud of, even though they may have seemed justified at the time. Let's say these choices are playing havoc with your relationship. What do you do? What do you say? First, you acknowledge that you're not compelled to keep making these choices. You can opt for something different, something more beneficial for your marriage. Second, you gather courage and say to your wife, "I'm sorry. I know I've hurt you, but I would like to make the future different. I would like to love you in your language. I would like to meet your needs." I've seen countless marriages rescued from the brink of divorce when couples make the choice to love. Love doesn't erase the past, but it can make the future different. When we choose to actively express love in the primary love languages of our wives, we create an emotional climate in which we can deal with our past conflicts and failures. Where did our love go? Brent sat in my office, stone-faced and seemingly unfeeling. He hadn't come by his own initiative, but at my request. A week earlier, his wife, Becky, had been sitting in the same chair, weeping. Between her outbursts of tears, she managed to explain that Brant had told her that he no longer loved her and that he was leaving. She was devastated. When she regained her composure, she said, "We've both worked so hard on our careers the last 2 or 3 years. I knew that we weren't spending as much time together as we used to, but I thought we were working for a common goal. I can't believe what he's saying. He's always been such a kind and caring person. He's such a good father to our children. How could he do this to us?" I listened as she described their 12 years of marriage. It was a story I'd heard many times before. They had an exciting courtship, got married at the height of the in-love experience, had the typical adjustments in the early days of marriage, and pursued the American dream. In due time, they came down off the emotional high of the in-love experience, but didn't learn to speak each other's love language sufficiently. She'd lived with a love tank only half full for the last several years, but she'd received enough expressions of love to make her think that everything was okay. Brent's love tank, on the other hand, was empty. His outward appearance was in stark contrast to Becky's. She had been weeping, but he was stoic. I had the impression, however, that his tears had been shed weeks or perhaps months before, and that it had been an inward weeping. The story Brent told confirmed my hunch. "I just don't love her anymore," he said. "I haven't loved her for a long time. I don't want to hurt her, but we're not close. Our relationship has become empty. I don't enjoy being with her anymore. I don't know what happened. I wish it were different, but I don't have any feelings for her." Brent was thinking and feeling what countless other husbands have thought and felt through the years. It's the "I don't love her anymore" mindset that gives men the emotional freedom to seek love with someone else. The same is true for wives who use the same excuse. When two people fall in love. I sympathized with Brent because I've been there, feeling emotionally empty, wanting to do the right thing, not wanting to hurt anyone, but being pushed by emotional needs to seek love outside the marriage. Fortunately, I'd discovered in the early years of my marriage the difference between the in-love experience and the emotional need to feel loved. Most in our society have not yet learned that difference. The in-love experience is practically instinctive. It's not premeditated. It simply happens in the normal context of male-female relationships. It can be fostered or quenched, but it doesn't arise by conscious choice. It's short-lived, usually 2 years or less, and seems to serve for humankind the same function the mating call does for the Canadian goose. The in-love experience temporarily meets our emotional need for love. It gives us the feeling that someone cares, that someone admires us and appreciates us. Our emotions soar with the thought that another person sees us as the one, that she's willing to devote time and energies exclusively to our relationship. For a brief period, however long it lasts, our emotional need for love is met. Our tank is full. We can conquer the world. Nothing is impossible. For many individuals, it's the first time they've ever lived with a full emotional tank, and it's euphoric. You can't plan to fall in love with someone. You can only go along for the ride. In time, however, we come down from that natural high back to the real world. If our wife has learned to speak our primary love language, our need for love will continue to be satisfied. If, on the other hand, she doesn't speak our love language, our tank will slowly drain and will no longer feel loved. Meeting that need in one's spouse is definitely a choice. If I learn the emotional love language of my wife and speak it frequently, she will continue to feel loved. When she comes down from the obsession of the in-love experience, she will hardly even miss it because her emotional love tank will continue to be filled. However, if I haven't learned her primary love language or have chosen not to speak it, when she descends from the emotional high, she will have the natural yearnings of unmet emotional needs. After some years of living with an empty love tank, she will likely fall in love with someone else, and the cycle will begin again. Meeting my wife's need for love is a choice I make each day. If I know her primary love language and choose to speak it, her deepest emotional needs will be met, and she will feel secure in my love. If she does the same for me, my emotional needs will be met, and both of us will live with full love tanks. In a state of emotional contentment, both of us will give our creative energies to projects outside the marriage while we continue to keep our relationship exciting and growing. Running on empty. With all of that in mind, I looked back at the deadpan face of Brent and wondered if I could help him. I knew in my heart that he was probably already involved with another in-love experience. I wondered if it was in the beginning stages or at its height. Few men suffering from an empty emotional love tank leave their marriages until they have prospects of meeting that need somewhere else. Brent was honest and revealed that he'd been in love with someone else for several months. He had hoped that the feelings would go away and that he could work things out with his wife. But the situation at home had gotten worse, and his love for the other woman had increased. He'd reached the point where he couldn't imagine living without his new lover. I sympathized with Brent in his dilemma. He sincerely didn't want to hurt his wife or his children, but at the same time, he felt he deserved a life of happiness. I gave him the dismal statistics on second marriages. He was surprised to hear them, but was certain that he would beat the odds. I told him about the research on the effects of divorce on children, but he was convinced that he would continue to be a good father to his children and that they would get over the trauma of the divorce. I talked to him about the issues in this book and explained the difference between the experience of falling in love and the deep emotional need to feel loved. I explained the 5 love languages and challenged him to give his marriage another chance. All the while, I knew that my intellectual and reasoned approach to marriage, compared to the emotional high that he was experiencing, was like pitting a BB gun against an automatic weapon. He expressed appreciation for my concern and asked that I do everything possible to help Becky, but he declared that he saw no hope for the marriage. 1 month later, I received a call from Brent. He asked to talk with me again. This time when he entered my office, he was noticeably disturbed. He was not the calm, cool man I'd seen before. His lover had begun to come down from the emotional high, and she was observing things in Brent that she didn't like. She was withdrawing from the relationship, and he was crushed. Tears came to his eyes as he told me how much she meant to him and how unbearable it was to experience her rejection. I listened for an hour before Brent ever asked for my advice. I told him how sympathetic I was to his pain and indicated that what he was experiencing was the natural emotional grief from a loss and that the grief would not go away overnight. I explained, however, that the experience was inevitable. I reminded him of the temporary nature of the in-love experience, that sooner or later we always come down from the high to the real world. Some fall out of love before they get married, others after they get married. He agreed that it was better now than later. After a while, I suggested that perhaps the crisis was a good time for him and his wife to get some marriage counseling. I reminded him that true, long-lasting emotional love is a choice, and that emotional love could be reborn in his marriage if he and his wife learned to love each other in the right love languages. He agreed to marriage counseling. Fast forward to 9 months later. Brent and Becky left my office with a reborn marriage. When I saw Brent 3 years after that, he told me what a wonderful marriage he had and thanked me for helping him at a crucial time in his life. He told me that the grief over losing his other lover had been gone for more than 2 years. He smiled and said, "My love tank has never been so full, and Becky is the happiest woman you're ever going to meet." Fortunately for Brent and his marriage, he had a brush with what I call the disequilibrium of the in-love experience. That is, almost never do two people fall in love on the same day, and almost never do they fall out of love on the same day. You don't have to be a social scientist to recognize that truth. Just listen to an hour of country music. Brent's lover happened to have fallen out of love with him at an opportune time. Getting the hang of it. In the 9 months that I counseled Brent and Becky, we worked through numerous conflicts that they'd never resolved before. But the key to the rebirth of their marriage was discovering each other's primary love language and choosing to speak it frequently. What if the love language of my spouse is something that doesn't come naturally for me? I'm often asked this question at my marriage seminars. My answer is, so? My wife's love language is acts of service. One of the things I do for her regularly as an act of love is vacuum the floors. Do you think that vacuuming floors comes naturally for me? My mother used to make me vacuum. All through junior high and high school, I couldn't go play ball on Saturday until I finished vacuuming the entire house. In those days, I said to myself, when I get out of here, there's one thing I'm never going to do again. I'm not going to vacuum my house. I'll get myself a wife to do that. But I vacuum our house now, and I vacuum it regularly. And there's only one reason I vacuum our house. Love. You couldn't pay me enough to vacuum a house, but I do it for love. You see, when an action doesn't come naturally to you, it is a greater expression of love. My wife knows that when I vacuum the house, it's nothing but 100% pure, unadulterated love. And I get credit for the whole thing. Someone might say, but Dr. Chapman, that's different. I know that my wife's love language is physical touch, but I'm not a toucher. I never saw my mother and father hug each other. They never hugged me. I'm just not wired that way. What am I going to do? Do you have two hands? Can you put them together? Now imagine that you have your wife in the middle and pull her toward you. I'll bet that if you hug your wife 3,000 times, it will begin to feel more comfortable. Ultimately, our comfort isn't the issue. We're talking about love. And love is something you do for someone else, not something you do for yourself. Most of us do many things each day that don't come naturally for us. For some of us, that list starts with getting out of bed in the morning. We go against our feelings and get out of bed. Why? Because we believe there's something worthwhile to do that day. And normally, before the day is over, we feel good about having gotten up. Our actions precede our emotions. The same is true with love. When you discover the primary love language of your wife, you choose to speak it, whether or not it's natural or comfortable for you. You may not get warm, excited feelings while you're doing it, but that's okay. You're simply choosing to do it for her benefit. You want to meet your wife's emotional need, so you reach out to speak her love language. In so doing, her emotional love tank is filled, and chances are she'll reciprocate and speak your language. When she does, your emotions return, and your love tank begins to fill. Love is a choice, and either partner can start the process today. Chapter 9. How can you work through anger together? Anger, left unchecked, can disrupt the flow of love languages indefinitely. Before you can communicate genuine love and affection to your wife, you must address the flashpoint issues that cause conflict. Come up with an effective plan for dealing with anger when it rears its head. In this chapter, you'll find the tools, strategies, and encouragement to help you and your wife work through your feelings of anger and strengthen your relationship in the process. I don't ever remember losing my temper until I got married. Dan may have been looking back at his bachelor years through rose-colored glasses, but he was certain of one thing. Sarah provoked his anger. When she says certain things or gives me that look, I get furious. Sarah's sarcastic questions bothered him. How's a guy supposed to respond when his wife asks, "Are you going to mow the lawn, or do I have to ask my father to come over and do it?" And that wasn't even the worst of it, as far as Dan was concerned. Sometimes Sarah would tilt her head a certain way and stare at him. "That look is worse than 1,000 condemning words," Dan confided in me. "What I see in her eyes is, 'I'm sorry I married you.'" Dan was angry because Sarah struck at his self-esteem, a particularly vulnerable spot. Most of us want to be liked, accepted, appreciated, and respected. So when we're criticized, we tend to respond defensively. Sarah may argue that she's criticizing Dan's behavior, not his person. But since our behavior is an extension of who we are, it's difficult for most of us, including Dan, to make the distinction. Something deep within Dan said, "It's not right for my wife to put me down." The tone of Sarah's voice made it clear that she, too, was angry. She'd concluded that Dan wasn't doing his fair share around the house. From her perspective, the grass grew taller while he went to the gym. He watched TV while she carried out the garbage. Not exactly her idea of a loving husband. Dan and Sarah's situation is hardly unique. All married couples deal with anger issues, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with experiencing anger. The problem is, many couples have never learned how to process it productively. Instead, they explode in tirades that do nothing but make the situation worse, or they suffer in silence and withdraw from each other. How many of us can look back on our childhood and remember outings that were spoiled not by weather, but by our parents' anger toward each other? How many birthdays have been ruined by the bickering of parents who haven't learned to resolve their anger? How many holidays have become days of misery because of anger run rampant? Unfortunately, most married adults have never learned how to handle anger properly. As a result, marriage becomes a battlefield, with each spouse accusing the other of firing the first shot. Until the couple learns to properly handle their anger, they'll never have a satisfying marriage. Their efforts to learn each other's love language will never pay dividends. I say never because love and uncontrolled anger cannot coexist. Love seeks the well-being of the spouse, while uncontrolled anger seeks to hurt and destroy. Six keys to anger management. The good news is that couples can learn to handle anger responsibly. In fact, they must learn this if they are to survive and thrive. It's not an easy process, but the results are certainly worth the effort. Let's break it down into six steps. 1. Acknowledge the reality of anger. When two people become one and attempt to build a life together, anger is inevitable. Some anger will be definitive, stimulated by wrong action on the part of a spouse. Some anger will be distorted, sparked by a misunderstanding of what happened. The average marriage couple will experience a fair share of both types of anger. That's just the byproduct of living life with a fallible human being. There's nothing inherently morally wrong about anger. It's simply evidence of our concern for fairness and justice. When we sense something is unfair or unjust, anger is our natural reaction. There's no need to condemn ourselves or our wife for experiencing anger. Likewise, there's no need to deny being angry. There's no shame in it. When we give each other the right to feel anger, we're actually giving each other the right to be human. This is the starting place in learning to process anger positively. One of the most loving gifts you can give your wife is the freedom to feel anger toward you. 2. Agree to acknowledge your anger to each other. When you are angry, give your wife the benefit of knowing what you're feeling. Or if your wife is angry, allow her to tell you how she feels. Don't play guess my mood. Such guessing games are a waste of time. Even worse, they rarely produce an accurate answer. If you're angry toward your wife, it's because she's done or said something that you believe is inappropriate, or because she's failed to do or say something that you expected. As far as you're concerned, she's done you wrong. She's treated you unkindly, unfairly, unlovingly. In that moment, the event that triggered your anger has become a barrier between the two of you. Your wife deserves to know that. She can't work on a problem she's unaware of. Each spouse deserves to know when the other is angry and what they're angry about. A husband and wife who commit to giving each other this information have taken a major step toward resolving anger productively. 3. Agree that verbal or physical explosions that attack the other person are not appropriate responses to anger. The unhealthy venting of anger is always destructive and should not be accepted as appropriate behavior. That doesn't mean that once you and your wife make the agreement, neither of you will ever lose your cool again. What it means is that you're committed to acknowledging that the response was wrong. Explosive expressions of anger always make things worse, and the emotional debris from those explosions must be cleared before you can deal constructively with the incident that triggered the anger. One practical way to break the habit is to agree that whenever either of you begins to explode, the other will walk out of the room. If the exploder follows, the spouse will walk out of the house, into the yard, around the block if necessary. And the walking away won't stop until the exploding does. If you both agree to that strategy, you'll know that when one of you leaves the room or house, it's time to stop and reflect on what's happening. Ideally, when the mobile spouse returns from the walk, the angry spouse will have calmed down and will have the humility and presence of mind to say, "I'm sorry. My exploding at you was wrong. I guess I was so hurt and angry that I lost control. Please forgive me." If the two of you can reconcile after that momentary lapse of control, you can get to the issue that originally caused the anger. 4. Agree to seek an explanation before passing judgment. If you're angry with your wife, your first impression is that her behavior is wrong. Just make sure you treat it as a first impression and not a confirmed fact until you hear her side of the story. It's all too easy to misinterpret someone's words or actions. Let's say your wife didn't come home with the gallon of milk you asked her to buy, even after she wrote a note to herself as a reminder. The knee-jerk reaction to her oversight would be to get angry at her apparent irresponsibility. But what if the store was out of milk? What if she drove a coworker home from the office and didn't go past a store? What if she knew you didn't need milk for dinner and planned to pick it up on her way to take your daughter to gymnastics? All plausible explanations. And if you're committed to seeking an explanation, you'll withhold your judgment of irresponsibility until you get her perspective. Rob overheard his wife on the phone say that he was late and that she couldn't stand being late. He felt angry because he'd made every effort to be there on time and was only 2 minutes late. When he asked his wife for an explanation, he found that she was actually talking about a friend's baby who arrived 2 weeks late. Crisis averted. If actions and words are open to misunderstanding, motives are even more difficult to guess. Since motives are internal, we can never know our wife's reason for doing something until she tells us. Unfortunately, we often attribute motives to our wife that are totally off base. Jonathan was acting wisely when he said, "I may be misreading this, and that's why I'm asking for an explanation. It looks to me like you charged $300 at Macy's. I thought we agreed that neither of us would spend over $100 without consulting the other until we get our debts under control." He was stunned by Bethany's response. "Oh, honey, I can explain. Our department at work went in together to buy Betsy a retirement gift. They asked me to pick it up during my lunch hour since I was meeting Ginger at the mall. So I put the whole thing on Visa. But they each gave me $20. It's in my purse. I think I have $300. Jonathan's anger subsided as he counted the $300. The next time you're convinced that your wife has done something to make you angry, ask yourself if you've ever been wrong before. 5. Agree to seek a resolution. In the case of Jonathan and Bethany, Jonathan's anger was resolved once he received Bethany's explanation. Obviously, not all anger resolution is that easy. Not all incidents turn out to be misunderstandings. Let's assume that Bethany had actually broken their commitment and made a $300 purchase after agreeing that neither of them would purchase anything over $100 without discussing it with the other. Let's assume her explanation was, "But honey, it was on sale. I saved $200, and we need it. I didn't think you would object." "Well, I do object," Jonathan replies. "It would be nice to have it, but we don't really need it. We've gotten along pretty well without it, and we can't afford to add $300 to our debt. We made an agreement, and you broke it. I think that's wrong." That kind of direct, loving confrontation opens the door to all kinds of constructive conversation and problem solving. A quick, heartfelt exchange of "I love yous" after a bout with anger will strengthen your relationship and protect it from fallout. 6. Agree to affirm your love for each other. After the anger is resolved, say to each other with all sincerity, "I love you." What you're really saying is, "I'm not going to allow this incident to separate us." As a couple, you've heard each other out, resolved the issue, learned from the experience, and agreed to move on together. In situations where a true wrong has been committed, where one spouse has been unkind, unloving, or unjust, an admission of the wrongdoing and a change of behavior are in order. So is forgiveness from the spouse who was wronged. At that point, the anger ignited by the incident can go dormant again, having served its purpose of holding both spouses accountable for their behavior. If the anger turns out to be distorted, the result of a misunderstanding, a different approach must be taken. After setting the record straight, the spouse who jumped to conclusions should be big enough to own up to their mistake. The couple can then talk about the circumstances that led to the misunderstanding and brainstorm some ideas for avoiding the situation in the future. Few things are more important to a successful marriage than learning to resolve anger in a responsible manner. I believe a genuine commitment to these 6 principles will set you and your wife on a path toward responsible anger management. As if you needed more reasons. Evidence from the world of academia that anger can be hazardous to your health. An Ohio State study found that a 30-minute marital spout can add a day or more to the time it takes a physical wound to heal. A Harvard study reported that older men inclined to explosive anger are at 3 times greater risk of a heart attack than their calmer peers. Is this a good time to talk? Let me close this chapter with one final suggestion. On an index card, write the following words. "I'm feeling angry right now, but don't worry. I'm not going to attack you, but I do need your help. Is this a good time to talk?" Put the card on your bathroom mirror or in some other accessible place. The next time you feel anger toward your wife, read the card aloud to her as calmly as you can. If it turns out not to be a good time to talk, set a time for later. In this brief statement, you've acknowledged that you're experiencing anger, you've affirmed your commitment not to explode, and you've expressed your desire for an explanation and resolution through conversation. When you sit down to discuss the issue, begin by saying, "I know that I could be misunderstanding this. That's why I wanted to talk to you. Let me tell you what I'm feeling and why. Then, if you can straighten the situation out, I'd appreciate it because I need help in resolving it." An opening like that creates a non-threatening atmosphere in which the two of you can discuss the situation. Anger will make occasional visits to every household, but we need not dread its arrival. Anger can be a friend. It can play a valuable role in your relationship. It can bring you and your wife together in ways other emotions can't. Every time the two of you work through a bout of anger, you strengthen your relationship a little more. 6 steps for diffusing an angry confrontation. The next time an anger-causing situation arises, try working through these steps with your wife. For maximum effectiveness, you should have these steps in place in your relationship before the situation arises. 1. Acknowledge the reality of